This fall, get back in the game with EverPlay Sports and Social League, Columbia's home for fun, fitness, and friends. We've got leagues firing up all over town starting September 7th. Mushball softball at T.S. Martin Park, pickleball at Casey Pickleball Complex, turf soccer at Recreation Arena, indoor volleyball at Tri-City Leisure Center, bowling at Lucky Strikes, sand volleyball at Pollywogs, soccer at B Avenue and Bray Park, cornhole at Jay's Corner, hardball softball at Pacific Park, and kickball at M Avenue and B Avenue, including our same team pitch option. Kick it all off at the fall kickoff party, Thursday, September 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Jay's Corner. We're giving away a ton of random raffles, and it's the perfect chance to meet your teammates before the season starts. Register by August 21st to dodge the late fees and score some limited edition fall league shirts. Hit everplaysocial.com to lock in your spot. EverPlay Sports and Social, play hard, party harder. Hey everybody, Barrett from the All About Nothing podcast. Look, one of the things we love to do is shout out small businesses doing cool things, and ZJZ Designs is one of them. They make these awesome seasonal and themed t-shirts, and they're not just eye-catching, they're high quality. I've ordered a few, and they've held up in the wash after wash. Plus, it feels good knowing I'm supporting a creative shop, not just feeding the Amazon machine. So if you want something fresh, funny, and made with a little extra heart, hit up ZJZDesigns.com. You'll definitely find something there to love. ZJZDesigns.com. Check them out. Get ready, Columbia. Soda City Comic Con 2025 is turning up the heat this summer. It all goes down August 23rd and 24th at the Columbia Metropolitan Convention Center, and the guest lineup is already packed with fan favorites. Let's start with Katie Sackhoff.
Yeah.
Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica and Bo-Katan Kreese from The Mandalorian and Clone Wars. She's a sci-fi icon and one of the coolest people to ever wield a blaster. Then there's John Heder, the man, the myth, the Napoleon Dynamite. From Blades of Glory to Surf's Up and everything awkwardly hilarious in between, he's bringing the signature charm to Soda City. And rounding it out, we've got Caitlin Robrock, the incredible voice of Minnie Mouse in Mickey Mouse Funhouse, Minnie's Bowtie Tunes, and many more. She's also voiced characters in Agrisuco, Amphibia, and Mr. Pickles, a true animation powerhouse. They'll all be there, signing autographs, taking selfies, and meeting fans all weekend long. And this is just the beginning. Even more celebrity guests are being announced, so keep checking SodaCityComicCon.com for the latest updates, guest lists, ticket info, and VIP perks. Make your summer unforgettable. Grab those tickets and come celebrate all things pop culture at Soda City Comic Con.
The All About Nothing podcast may have language and content
that isn't appropriate for some. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome, Nothingers, to the All About Nothing podcast. This is episode number 266. I am Barrett Gruber. We finally have made it into the month of August. And for most of you that live in areas where you listen to this podcast, chances are you noticed that it was August because you're probably melting too. And if you're listening to us south of the equator, congratulations, your Christmas will be in the summer. Please subscribe and share the show. It's how we get new listeners. Also, please consider supporting the show financially by visiting theallaboutnothing.com and becoming an official member and proudly calling yourself a true nothing. We'll have more details on that at the end of the show. If you can't do that, please give us a 5-star review, a like, and follow us across social media. You can find links at theallaboutnothing.com. Real quick, I want to remind everybody, putt-putt like a pro at the 10th Masters of Putt-Putt Friday, August 22nd at Frankie's Fun Park. You can get your team signed up by August 21st and don your best themed costumes because the best dressed team also wins prizes. Make sure to arrive before 6:45 because they tee off sharp. Also want to remind everybody that the Soda City Comic Con is coming up August 23rd, 24th. That is this month at the Columbia Metropolitan Convention Center. Go to SodaCityComicCon.com. Also, there are VIP tickets available, so you want to do that. Plenty of stars being announced. Check Soda City Comic Con for all the details on vendors and stars. We are going to get this episode started. This week, my guest is Dr. Michael Orkin, who is the author of the second edition of The Story of Chance. This time, it's Beyond the Margin of Error. He has a BA in mathematics and a PhD in statistics. Welcome, Dr. Orkin, to the All About Nothing podcast. How are you?
Thank you, Barrett. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here. I've listened to several of the podcasts that you've done, and I feel like they all open up with some sort of a quiz on what it is statistically likely to either be struck by lightning or statistically likely to win the lottery or a shark attack. I want to go a little shallower than that. Food poisoning. Okay. What's the likelihood of food poisoning because of bad meat?
Gee, I don't even know the answer to that. There's a great website, which is called the National Research Council or something like that, that has those things. What's the chance of dying by weird things? Like, what's the chance of being killed by a hornet, wasp, or bee sting?
Or I'm way up there on that one. Yeah, I am allergic to yellow jackets. So. Okay.
Or what's the chance of being struck by lightning? That's one that everybody talks about. And other things, what's the chance of being killed by being by hot water, by scalding water? All kinds of things. If you're interested in those things, you can find them on that website.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you didn't actually know off the top of your head, because I feel like that's probably a party foul. You walk in there and everybody's having drinks and they say, oh, Dr. Orkin's here. He's probably going to tell us about what the likelihood is of falling down these stairs. You know, that isn't really necessarily why you're here. Your book, The Story of Change, Beyond the Margin of Error, Story of Chance. Sorry. You know what it is? It's my poor handwriting. But The Story of Chance, Beyond the Margin of Error, available on Amazon. Check the show notes for links to make the purchase of that. But this is the second edition of this book. And basically, I went through and did just a quick reading through it, and randomness and probability, casino and gambling strategies, polls and statistics. One of the things I am interested in and that I watch as far as like television programs and things like that are some of the programs where there is some extremely intelligent gambler who knows how to read the cards and things like that. But before we get into that, please tell us about yourself, like where you're from, how this all came together.
Okay, well, I grew up on the East Coast in the Washington, D.C. area, and sort of knew about Berkeley, California. Back in those days, it was a well-known place. And they also, I was interested in math, and they have a good math department at Cal Berkeley. And so I decided to go there. Also, it got me as far away from home in the continental United States as I could get. Not that I had any big conflicts with my parents. I just wanted to be on my own. And so I became a math major, and I was planning just to go work for IBM for a while in the summers. And so I was planning to just go back and work for a computer company when I graduated. But a professor I had when I took a class in probability when I was a senior convinced me to go to graduate school in the statistics department there. And he told me I didn't have to worry about anything. I just have to fill out a one-page form, and that was it. And so why not? And so I did, and I really liked it. And I got supported by various research grants while I was a graduate student. And then after that's how I got through graduate school. And then so I got a job teaching. My first professor job was at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. And I had culture shock, so I wanted to get back to Berkeley as quickly as possible. So the next year, I only stayed there a year. Great school, I might say. And just wasn't what I was used to, that's all.
Sure.
So then I got a job at California State University Hayward at the time. It's now called California State University East Bay. So I stayed there for a long time, then started getting lots of consulting jobs. So I left and did consulting for a few years, and then I wanted to get back into teaching, especially online teaching. So that's what I do now, among other things. And I teach at Berkeley City College. Berkeley.
Let me ask you about the consulting. When it becomes, what exactly was your job function as a consultant? What was it that you did?
Well, I've had a variety of consulting jobs. To start out with, I was consulting mainly with attorneys and who needed a statistical expert. So one of my first consulting jobs was in actually a mass murder case it was in Northern California, and they had a retrial. This guy's name was Juan Corona, and he was accused of murdering 25 farm workers. He was a farm worker himself. And so they needed very statistical things, like they wanted to change the jury, do a change of venue, to move the trial to a different place, which needs statistical survey, because they said he couldn't get a fair trial in Yuba County, California. The first trial was in Solano County. The crimes took place in Yuba County. And then they also wanted to challenge the racial composition of the grand jury that indicted him, various things like that. And then I developed a computer system during sort of the pre-trial time, which was like a search engine before there were any search engines, in which there were like 50,000 pages of police reports from the time the crimes were committed, which was over about a six-month period. And so I wrote a search engine, which allowed the attorneys to go through and quickly just say any item like the Guadalajara Cafe, where there was a weird incident, and it would immediately pick all the police reports that had that mentioned.
Okay.
So we did that. So there are various statistical chores, a lot of them having to do with challenging this or that, like the grand jury composition and looking for a change of venue. So that was, I had a number of consulting jobs like that. That's sort of the bread and butter of a lot of statistics people, or was in those days. And then though, over the years, things changed. The internet came along and game development became very common. There are lots of game developers. And in order to develop a game that's going to be online, it's going to be on, let's say, on the App Store for the iPhone or the Android, be available on the Android, you have to backed up by a bank, because these are games where you have to use money, so gambling type games. So you have to get all these approvals, and there are state regulators. And one of the regulations that's sort of not uniform across the states, but is fairly common, was that the game has to be a game of skill, not a game of chance. So that's sort of being relaxed. But how do you show that a game is a game of skill and not a game of chance? Well, somebody like me has to analyze it. Because there are some games that you, like the game of craps where you roll dice, that you can show mathematically in about 10 seconds that that's a game of chance. But how do you show that a game is a game of skill? Well, you could say that games like bowling and golf and football and tennis are games of skill, or chess and checkers. But most of the games being developed, it's not so clear. And so I would have to write a report showing that this game is a game of skill. So my report would go into a big packet that the lawyers would present to the regulators or the bank or whoever to get this game available for wagering online.
And I it's something that I've never actually given any consideration, because a lot of the games that I play are usually word games. So obviously that is going to default into a game of skill.
Right.
What sort of games, I guess, maybe like gambling games or card games or something like that, those would be typically the games of luck, right?
Well, so a lot of card games, yes. But for example, blackjack is sort of a debatable game, because back in the late 1950s, computer simulations showed that you could exercise some skill if you learn how to count cards as they're being dealt out of the deck in a certain way. So Ed Thorpe wrote the book Beat the Dealer. He was a math professor back in 1962, still in print. So blackjack is one game where you can argue that there's skill involved. But mostly I haven't had to deal with card games. A lot of the gaming that goes on online is somehow related to sports betting.
Sure.
That's happened over the last few years. I mean, FanDuel and DraftKings are these enormous companies now. Ever since the internet gambling on sports became legal on a federal level, the states can decide for themselves. So, for example, here in California, it's illegal to bet on sports. In Nevada, it's been legal for a long time.
Right.
The laws are very weird, and things are grandfathered in. For instance, in California, because of various political reasons, you can't bet on sports. Political reasons, like most of the casinos in California are run by directly or indirectly by Indian reservations, and they have a very strong lobby and don't want sports betting to cut into their business. Also, horse racing is legal in California. There are a number of racetracks. There's one up near here, Golden Gate Fields. But why is horse racing any more a game of skill than betting on sports? Some people argue that horse racing is a sport. Well, the answer is, if you look at the law specifies all these reasons for games that would be considered games of chance and therefore not allowed. And then at the end, it says, except for horse racing. So that's what's known as grandfathering something in.
Right.
But a lot of the clients that I've had in the last few years have been doing things, like, for instance, I have one client that I did a number of projects for who has software that allows you to organize your own pools for sports, like football pools, basketball pools. And then there are others that do things that are not quite betting on sports, so they get around the laws. Involve sports. And so I have to analyze those. But what I have to do mainly is look at player data and see if there's some players who in the trial data who do better than chance. And so that's sort of a statistical argument that this is a game of skill, or at least a game where some people who work hard and study how the rules are set up can do better than just if it were a game of chance. And so that's like a fundamental theme in statistics. Then there's also a few companies that I've had as clients. There's one big company in India that's taking classic games like bowling, things like that you can do online, you know, just things that are, and just repurposing them so you can bet on them. There's a game called Chutes and Ladders that's a common game. In India, they call it Snakes and Ladders. So it's a snake, not a chute. But so they've repurposed it to be a game you can bet on. And so it's just crazy. But you can show that these are games of skill because they take the hand-eye coordination and things like that. So there's a whole wide range of, but that's basically my main type of consulting these days.
Well, to go back to the consulting that you did for the lawyers for that trial specifically, obviously this has to become a Netflix special at some point. Who do you think would be the most appropriate person to potentially play you in the Netflix special? I'm thinking Jeff Goldblum.
Well, yeah, good. I like that.
Okay. Yeah. I think that would be appropriate.
Yeah, I really like Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And one of
he's a lot taller than I am, but
one of the most kind individuals I think I've ever seen in my entire life.
Well, he's a great actor.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Yeah. Jurassic Park was amazingly good.
For me, I'm just excited about the fact that he is now part of Marvel MCU canon. Like Jeff Goldblum. Yeah. And not just Jeff Goldblum, but Jeff Goldblum's personality is part of the Marvel universe.
Yeah.
Going back to the horse racing, statistically, what is, and besides just doing research on jockeys and horses, is there anything outside of that that you could potentially use to greater your odds in potentially choosing the right horse?
Well, there's a lot of kinds of data available. It's one of the most data-filled activities in the world. And it has been for years, long before the internet. There's something called the Daily Racing Form that has tons of data on every single race at every single track in the world. And it comes out every day or almost every day. And people would study that. You buy it at the track, or you can get a subscription or get it at the newsstand. Old fashioned, no internet. And of course, you can get the stuff online too. But people when you go to the track, you see lots of people studying the Daily Racing Form. And it tells how every horse, let's say a particular race, it tells how every horse in that race does under similar conditions, like muddy track or cold weather or whatever. And it also gives data on the past performances of that horse, of races of that type. There are lots of different types of races. There are things called claiming races and sweepstakes and all kinds of races. But anyway, the Daily Racing Form has it all. So that's like one of the original data warehouses.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, is there any benefit to knowing what the jockey ate for breakfast, or is that just a...
There might be. I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think you can get that information in the form. But there is, I mean, and I don't know if you get this. I don't think you can get this in the racing form either, but it might be good to know what kind of health the jockey's in.
Sure.
If the jockey is very sick, then they're not going to do as well. But
yeah.
I don't think that information is readily available.
Oh, that's a shame. No, it's interesting. So, you know, you mentioned blackjack earlier and you know, skill versus luck. So one of the things that when we would go on cruises, and I mentioned to you this when we did our pre-interview a couple weeks ago, but like I would go on cruises as soon as we crossed in international waters and the casino opened, I would usually spend the first 6-7 hours in the casino playing blackjack. And I would only play at blackjack tables that had dealers. I didn't like playing the computers, but I would also only play blackjack when I had other people playing blackjack. I never wanted it to be just me and the dealer. But after about 6 or 7 hours, I usually made enough to cover. And this was when cruises were cheaper. I usually made enough to cover the cost of the cruise.
Wow, that's good.
And then I was done. But that was, you know, blackjack for me, like it wasn't necessarily about counting cards. I don't think, and it wasn't some innate talent that I had, but I did function pretty well in recognizing that as long as the dealer didn't get blackjack, you know, I generally could, you know, if it was 16 or higher, I stayed. If it was under 16, I always hit and I had pretty good luck. But I could also see what cards, and I sat at the end of the table, so I could see what cards the other players were getting, and that worked out to my benefit.
Yeah, well, so seeing what cards the other players are getting means that you're sort of counting cards, maybe in a primitive way, but you are. And then there's something called the basic strategy where you don't have to count cards, or it becomes almost an even game. So if you're a little bit lucky, you'll come out ahead. But where you do things have these rules, like what you were just saying, draw on any total less than six, less than 17, that is 16 or less, and hit on higher totals, just sort of in general. And that gets refined when you start looking at the basic strategy as it was, as Thorpe outlined it. So if the dealer has like a six showing, if it's a game where the dealer's whole card is not showing,
right,
and the dealer has this one cards up and the dealer has a six showing, then there's a good chance the dealer will bust. And so then you just don't draw on any total over 12. So that's called a basic strategy. You don't have to count cards, but some people, it sounds like you included, have, without reading any books on it, have this sort of intuitive grasp of that. My aunt was like that. My aunt was a champion bridge player. She used to travel around and play bridge tournaments. And she was a fanatic card player. I mean, just relentless. And she used to do very well in blackjack, but I don't think she ever read a blackjack book. But she used to, I mean, we went to Las Vegas once many, many years ago, and it was sort of a family reunion type thing, and it was getting late. So dinner was over, everyone went upstairs, and I came downstairs just to check out the casino around 1:30 in the morning, 1:30 a.m., and there was my aunt sitting at the blackjack table, and she saw me, and she said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I don't know, I'm just looking around." She said, "Well, don't bother me." So she got so focused, and she didn't. Okay.
I also want to tell everybody, you just recently started a Substack account called The Neutral Zone.
Correct.
Tell me what about that. Tell me what, okay, what was...
So my book, The Story of Chance, by the way, you called it The Story of Change.
Change,
before,
yeah, the chance.
But that's interesting because some people think that change can only come about due to chance, randomness. So anyway, that was a nice...
Oh, yeah.
Lead. Yeah, Story of Chance, here it is.
Yeah.
Beyond the Margin of Error, it's got some statistics in it. It's got math in it. And I use it, in fact, as a textbook in my classes. So I thought it might be nice to sort of distill some of the stories in the book and have a Substack without any math. And so the Substack stories are sort of, some of them are excerpts from the book, not all, but some are excerpts from my book without the math. Anybody can just read it as a nice story. So people who are interested in Substack can just go on Substack and look for The Neutral Zone. Everything I put up there so far is free, so you don't have to worry about being a subscriber yet.
Yeah, no, please cash in where you can.
Yeah, so 100%. I'm putting up a new story tonight, probably, if all goes well.
I enjoy reading the first one that I saw, which was, of course, talking about vaccines and whether or not they cause autism. This is something that's obviously been in the news. It's been politicized. Right. We now have a guy that's in charge, Robert Kennedy Jr., who is Robert Jr. Kennedy, whatever, obviously is a vaccine denier. He has been a vaccine denier over the course of, I guess, since it became popular. I don't know if it's been that way his entire... I don't know if he's been this way his entire life. He's significantly older than me, but at the same time, even in my generation, I'm 46, I have seen celebrities in this generation also become vaccine deniers. But, you know, that's one of the things you also discuss, and it's such an interesting topic, but there isn't any valid data to support the idea based on medical science. There isn't any data to support that vaccines cause autism.
That's correct. And in fact, one of the problems is data is so accessible these days that people like RFK Jr., who's now unfortunately the head of Health and Human Services. Before he became a vaccine, he calls himself a vaccine skeptic, or he did at one point, not a denier, although that's just playing word games.
Well, in his defense, I don't deny that ghosts exist. I'm skeptical.
Right. So that's sort of where he's coming from. But he's talking about a very serious area. And so, for example, the example I give in the Substack, the story I give is about the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, which has been around, the MMR vaccine, as it's called. It's been around for 50 years. It eliminated measles in this country. There's been a slight resurgence of measles in this country over the last few years because of families who don't want to give their kids the vaccine. Not a huge epidemic yet, but it might be. Like in Texas this year, there were a couple of kids who died from it. And the reason, so the MMR vaccine was established, went through enormous amounts of testing and statistical studies before it was introduced to the public. And then there were more studies. And then there was this guy, more recent times, named Andrew Wakefield, who was a physician, not a vaccine specialist, not an epidemiologist, just a regular physician in England, who published a study of about 12 cases, I think, in which a number of them, of vaccinated kids, among whom a number were diagnosed around that time, soon after they got the vaccine, with autism. Well, that's what these people like Kennedy, RFK Jr., jump on and say, okay, here's a study that contradicts all the previous studies. The problem is the study was a fraud, and it was proved to be a fraud. There were a couple of collaborating authors who withdrew their names. The journal Lancet, which is a well-known journal, that published it, retracted it. This guy was, for whatever reason, cherry-picking the data. In fact, there were lots of cases of kids with vaccines who didn't get autism, who he didn't put into his report. And so it was a fraud. I mean, everyone agrees in that public health world, agrees it was a fraud. Even his co-authors agreed it was a fraud. And since then, just in order to bolster the fact that the MMR vaccine is good and is safe, there have been 16 huge studies. There was a study all showing no evidence. See, in a statistical study, you show no evidence of something. That doesn't mean if you look at some other data in some other way, there might be something, but that's called cherry picking. There was one study in Denmark, a two-year study. These studies are very expensive. These clinical trials are very expensive, and you have to have a control group and an experimental group, which is difficult in situations like this. The one in Denmark looked at every single child born in Denmark to a Danish mother over a two-year period. There was, I think more than 100,000 births, 500,000, something like that. And they were able, because the study was so large, they were able to break it down into different categories, different groups, you know, mothers who smoke, older people, whatever. And in none of the ways they sliced and diced the data, did they find any evidence of autism caused by vaccine. And there were, like I said, 15 other big studies, I'm not talking about the smaller ones, that had the same conclusion. So none of the studies show any evidence of the MMR vaccine causing or even being related to, other than they're both the vaccine is given around the same time that the autism is diagnosed. And also back in the day, there wasn't as much precision in diagnosing autism, but now there is, so the more recent studies have the same result. So it's ludicrous, and it's causing people, kids, to die because of these. So people see these stories, like Kennedy says, well, we really need to have more data, or they didn't look at the data this way, with some way that they just manufactured. And what happens is the big studies, which take a long time to develop, don't get as much press. Kennedy was an environmental lawyer for many years before he got his new gig. And
it makes me uncomfortable when we call the director or we call that position a gig.
Yeah. Well, for him, I call it a gig.
Well, when your president is a TV appearance star, you know, that it's a gig.
You know, he's done, even in the past, I mean, you probably heard the bear story.
Yes.
In which he dumped a dead bear in Central Park as a joke, as a prank. He's done there are lots of stories like that. None of them are situations where he can get arrested or anything.
Right. Yeah. The massacre of a dead whale on a beach. Yeah. Not in itself probably a big crime. I mean, I think the natural resource, they had some issues with something, but ultimately the crime was committed against his children, who had to sit in the car as the whale was dripping onto them. So yeah, that's where the crime was.
Yeah. But so even if there's no crime, most people would say that's weird.
Yeah. And
so, you know, and there are various interviews with him where he says something and then he says, I didn't really mean to say that. But with the vaccines, there's just a fertile ground of being able to cherry pick data or to look at data, especially now that data is so widely available, and say, this study didn't look at such and such, you know, vegetarians who had tuberculosis. And if you add that to the vaccine, you get autism. So it's that kind of stuff. It's because in statistical studies, you never come out with these results like, there's no evidence that vaccines cause autism. So somebody like RFK Jr. can always say, well, yeah, but we want to look at the data in a little bit different way.
Well, data's data.
Yeah. And the thing is, though, there's this thing like, I mean, why do people win lotteries like the Mega Millions lottery or the Powerball?
Yeah.
Because the chance of winning the Mega Millions lottery is about 1 in 290 million. So if I go buy a lottery ticket, I can guarantee you I'm going to lose. I mean, I might get really, really, really lucky, but no, I'm not going to win.
It feels like a safe assumption.
Yeah, it is a safe assumption. But there are winners. And so the question is, why are there winners? I know I'm not going to win. And the answer is because so many tickets are sold. And so if you have enough opportunity, the question is, what's the chance that someone will win, not what's the chance that Mike Orkin will win? And if you say, what's the chance that someone will win? If you have 20 million people buying tickets to the Mega Millions lottery, the chance is sort of reasonable. It's like, it's not 1 in 290 million anymore. It's maybe 5% or 10% or something like that. So the same thing is true about all kinds of situations where there's enough data to look through and you'll find something.
Yeah.
I used to have a friend and I, a long time ago, wrote a program to find patterns in pro football games. And so the way it worked was it would search through the data, and whenever it found a pattern, so automatically search through the data. So we had, the data was maybe 5 years of football results, just teams, you know, what team, the 49ers, all the teams. And that's not very much data. I mean, if you look at data coming from public health sources, like the data you use, that are in some of the clinical trials for vaccines or other remedies, COVID vaccine, things like that, it's mammoth. But anyway, so we had this program that would automatic. It would look through the football data, keep looking and keep looking. And just by chance, just like if enough people buy tickets, you win the lottery. But if enough searches through the data in various different ways, you'll find something. These are just random patterns. But if you extract the random pattern and say, hey, when the 49ers play on the road and they lost the week before and it's not a Monday night game and they have to play on the road the following week, then that's what's known as a random pattern. You're not going to win any money when you bet on that. And the program would find those situations. And well, this week, the Buffalo Bills are in a very good situation because when they're in this situation, they win most of the time. And it's true. They win most of the time. But unfortunately, it's just random. So you can't use it to predict how they're going to do this week.
Well, and to add to that, we've had the Philadelphia Eagles have won the Super Bowl in the last 5 years twice or something like that. Statistically, I can guarantee there's going to be at least 300 arrests after the game in the streets. Right. And one person's obviously going to hang themselves from a light pole. It's going to happen.
Right.
It's not an anomaly anymore.
Right.
So we're speaking with Dr. Michael Orkin, who, of course, is the author of The Story of Chance, Beyond the Margin of Error. The book is available on Amazon. Chapter 19 starts out with, and I thought that this was pretty good, was Humpty Dumpty accident prone. I have to assume, based on my observations of Humpty Dumpty and all, you know, the number of times I've heard the story and things like that, he was potentially accident prone, right?
Right. Well, In chapter 19 in the book, one definition of accident prone, which is not a very good definition, it's a dictionary definition, says that accident prone means you have more accidents than average.
Okay.
So in the chapter on Humpty Dumpty, I compare Humpty Dumpty to other nursery rhyme characters.
Okay, yeah.
Like Jack and Jill and Little Miss Muffet and other, the mouse that ran up the clock, and show that Humpty Dumpty indeed had more than an average number of accidents because he fell off the wall. And because most of the nursery rhyme characters don't have any accidents at all. So
they get eaten or they...
Right, yeah. Other horrible things happen to them. Yeah. But, you know, along came a spider and sat down beside her. She didn't have an accident. She just ran away.
And so
I've done some consulting involving accidents, and the definition of accident prone can't be that you have more accidents than average. That doesn't make sense, because if you take any data whatsoever, if you just pick people off the street and look at their weights or their heights or their ages, there'll be some people who are, and take the average, there'll be some people greater than average and some people less than average. It doesn't say anything about them.
Yeah.
To say that if you're accident prone is a serious thing, because you can get fired from your job. You can lose your insurance or get your insurance rates raised. So you don't want to be labeled as accident prone. So saying that you have more accidents than average is not a very good definition. It has to be more than that. It has to be outside the margin of error, so to speak, which is the title of my book, in terms of how many accidents you have. It can't be within the range of chance, which is what the margin of error means. And so I had a consulting job a few years ago. The consulting job was, the client was the attorney of this woman who was fired, or trying to fire her from a job with this huge company because she was accident prone. So it's a serious thing. And so we looked at the data, and she indeed had some accidents, no serious accidents. This was a huge company with thousands of employees all over the country. I won't name them. The company, and she indeed had more accidents than average, or so it seemed. But that's not a reason to say that she's accident. So we had to, the way it worked is we had to see a mediator, we had to all meet with the mediator, the attorneys and me had to meet with a mediator to talk about it before going to court. And so their statistician had some data showing that she had more accidents than average. And so I made the point and said, you collect any data and look at the average and you'll find some bigger than average and some less. It doesn't have anything to do with anything. I mean, it's just a math thing. He then revealed that we asked how he got that average. And he said, well, from all the employees in the company. Well, it turned out that about half the employees had desk jobs, sitting in front of a computer all day. And the other half were out working on the outside.
Right.
But he lumped them all together. So this person who was our client, who got, they were trying to fire, had an outside job. So he did much more risk in what she was doing than somebody sitting at a computer. Well, the mediator just sort of looked at this and heard our thing, and they folded, the company folded, and they didn't fire her.
They retained her.
The mediator said, this is not going to trial. This is ridiculous. And she's still working there. This was many years ago when this happened. But the point is, and so since this is such an important topic, there are many, many thousands of research papers on this subject. And there's this new idea of accident, well, not new, it's been around for a while, this way of defining accident prone as being having a predisposition to having an accident. What is a predisposition? Well, I don't know what it is, but somehow there are people in a field called human factors, who sort of try to figure out what a predisposition is. Hopefully it means, so I have a good friend, a very good friend who's in the human factors business. So we've talked about this a lot because he deals with accidents. I used to work do consulting for a company that mainly involved in engineering accidents. But this idea of a predisposition could be all kinds of things. It can be that you're neurotic. It can be that you're an extrovert. So these are from papers I mentioned in the book. But anyway, the point is it has to be more than just having a greater number of accidents than average, because lots of people are going to get in trouble financially for no reason.
Yeah, and the two you named as being human factors weren't even the first ones I thought of. I thought age, you know, height, you know.
There are other things like, I mean, there are other serious things, like if you're a drug addict or if you're an alcoholic, that's a problem. Then I totally understand an insurance company not wanting to do business with you.
It feels like profiling a little bit, though.
No, I know. I mean, if you like automobile insurance is age. They basically.
I was gonna say age, gender, race. I mean,
or if you have a predisposition to accidents, right? that's what they'll tell you. Oh, you have a predisposition because you got in a fender bender last year. So we're going to raise your rate by 30%. So it's kind of a problematic area. We were going to write a paper on it, but we haven't gotten around to it yet. My friend is in human factors and my statistical view of it, but I do give him my statistical view of it in the book.
Yes. So one of the other things that your book dives into a little bit is Paul the Octopus. And
yes, Paul the Octopus.
I had to look this up. I had heard that there was an octopus, and actually when I was telling people we were going to be recording an episode with you, I was talking about the statistics and things like that, and I brought up Paul the Octopus, but I didn't bring up Paul the Octopus. I brought up the cephalopod that was in an aquarium in Germany, because I could think of the word cephalopod, but I couldn't think of the word octopus.
Octopus.
But yeah, so tell us about Paul the Octopus, because he gets highlighted around Super Bowl time. And
yeah. Well, yeah, so Paul the Octopus was a cephalopod. He was an octopus who was at an aquarium in Germany, and they trained him to try to pick the winner of a soccer match by selecting one of two food bowls. And there are two teams in a soccer match, so they'd have two food bowls, one for one team, one for the other team. And Paul would choose one of those food bowls to get some food. And if the food bowl that he chose was assigned to the team that won the game, that was good, because he's predicting who's going to win. So over the course of a season, including some playoff games and stuff, and it was in European soccer games, he picked 12 out of 14 winners. And so that's pretty good to get that good if you're just guessing. So the question is the same question that I have to answer when I look at this, when I try to decide if a game is a game of chance or a game of skill. The question is, was Paul the Octopus skilled, or is he just lucky? And so you would think, how can an octopus be skilled? And so the way you do it statistically is you compare Paul's result to random guessing and see if it's likely to happen, where it's within the margin of error for random guessing. Well, it turns out the chance to get 12 out of 14 or better right, which is what Paul did, is about 7 in 1,000, 0.007. Wow. It's 0.006 something, 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 but round it off, it's about 7 in 1,000, which is statistically significant. So statisticians have to draw the line somewhere to say whether something is beyond the margin of error, beyond chance, and something weird is going on, or something significant is going on, or if you're looking at things as chance versus skill, when you decide that there's skill or cheating going on. Usually, so classically, the line is drawn at 0.05, 5 in 100. Well, 0.0067, rounded off to 7 in 1,000, is way, way lower than 0.05. So a statistician would say, whoops, that Paul is not just guessing. Now, of course, there are things that you have to consider, like in these games, usually a favorite and underdog, maybe Paul's handler put the good food in the favorite's bowl.
Right.
So there are things like that, you know, cheating, not by Paul, but by the person who's making money off of Paul. And so you could argue that that's just, you know, it's just a scam or a trick that Paul's handler is doing. But that doesn't really a satisfactory answer, because there are lots of people paying attention to this when Paul went on this winning streak. So let's go back to the lottery analogy. Why do people win the Mega Millions lottery? It's not because they have skill. It's because so many people buy tickets. And somebody is going to win if there are enough tickets. So luck, I like to say, is a group activity. Given enough unlucky losers, there's going to be a lucky winner in that group. So if you have a large enough opportunity factor. So it makes one think, well, what if it's not? So it can't be just Paul who's making these picks, because it's very interesting. People read the papers or read whatever they read online and try to, and they're interested in the story about Paul the octopus picking winner. So you think there must be other animals who are also prognosticating. So just in that one article that I mentioned, in the story, there were about five or six other animals picking the same games. And that was just in this one article. I'm sure there were lots of others. There was an anteater and a cat and various other animals picking a bowl to try to pick these games. So it's quite, so if you look at, if there are just 10 animals altogether picking games the way Paul was, the chance of somebody doing something that crazy, 12 out of 14, goes up by 10 times. So it's no longer 6 in 1,000, it's 6 in 100. And so the question is, so the thing to look for is, what is the opportunity for something like that to happen? And in the case of Paul the octopus, there was plenty of opportunity in the context of lots of other animals picking the same games.
I go back to the lottery, and I just as an anecdote, I can tell you that when I worked in an office, this was before COVID, when the lottery would reach a certain point, whether it was, you know, half a billion dollars, if it was $500 million, then a lot of people in the office would participate, and we'd all go in on it. But we wouldn't use the random pick, which statistically, what I would do is I would go through and I created a database of the last 100 weeks of all of the numbers that were picked. And I would pick numbers that statistically came up more often for the first half of the tickets. And then the second half of the tickets, I would pick the numbers that hadn't come up more often because, you know, just playing the odds that they're due. That was my thought process.
Well, there are two things you're talking about, numbers that are due and numbers that are hot.
Right.
The ones that come up a lot. Yeah. So those are two things. Now, of course, the lottery, if the machinery is properly maintained, and there's no cheating going on, then it's all random. The winner is just a random thing.
Right.
And so it doesn't matter if you keep track of the numbers that are hot and the numbers that are due. It makes no difference for the next drawing. It's all just random. The thing that makes a difference is how many people buy tickets.
Right.
Because there will be a winner if lots of people buy tickets, depending on what the chances of winning. And that winner is just lucky. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with being lucky.
Well, here's the thing I found out was against the rules was I was doing all of that on company time. So, you know.
I think I mentioned this in the book. When you say you're doing that on company time, lots of people do that. I had a friend who was a lawyer, and he represented various nefarious people in the gambling world. And so there's a place in Berkeley called the China Station, Chinese restaurant. This was a long time ago. And they had a sports bar in front. And there was this guy who would go to the sports bar who was represented by my friend, Les. And this guy was called the plumber. And so I was introduced to, this is the plumber. And this guy was actually a bookie. He took bets all evening long, sports bar. And I asked him, why are you called the plumber? I thought, you know, some mob name.
Yeah.
He'll stuff someone's head in the toilet if they don't pay him. And he said, I'm a plumber. I am a plumber. I work as a plumber during the day, and I come here at night and take bets. And so anyway, I was walking through the back part of the restaurant and saw in the kitchen, there were some windows you could see in the kitchen. And they were like, everybody in the kitchen was sitting at a long table writing out lottery tickets. And there were like 20 guys, 20 people, some women too, writing out lottery tickets. And so I asked my friend Les, you know, what's going on there? And he said, oh, the chef is a lottery addict. And the day before the lottery drawing, he has all the staff sitting at this long table filling out tickets all day long. And I don't think they ever won the jackpot.
I was going to say, then came the days you could just walk up to the convenience store clerk and just say, give me 20 quick picks. You know, that's... Right. That's
you can't. Yeah, you can do the quick picks, but you can't. You can't say give me every possible combination.
Right.
Correct. How do you get a random picks?
So they were putting that much work into it.
These guys were actually just filling out certain combinations that the chef would give them, and they had some systematic way of having the staff at this restaurant doing that.
Wow.
It was much more sophisticated than quick picks, but it wasn't any better because it's random anyway.
Right.
So well, they were just wasting a lot of time.
Well, the most obvious follow-up question was, what was the DHEC grade on for the restaurant?
Well, they did it during the off times or late at night.
Sure, but was it a good restaurant? Was it?
Yeah, it was a good restaurant. It was a good restaurant.
Honestly, that's one of the things about San Francisco and like the whole Bay Area is the food is you find some of the best food. And I know it sounds stereotypical for me to say it, but California burritos, San Francisco burritos, the uniqueness is something that like I look forward to every time I visit San Francisco or Oakland or Richmond or whatever. It's I think that it's incredible.
The food, there's great food on all out where I live, which is a half hour from Berkeley. San Ramon was part of the Tri-Valley area. San Ramon,
yeah,
Dublin, Pleasanton, and there are a couple other cities, Livermore, Danville. Great food.
Yeah.
Absolutely great food. And that place that I mentioned, the China Station, was a great Chinese restaurant. It's no longer there. Right, it was called the China Station because it was right by the Amtrak. There's an Amtrak station. Just if you walk a block, and you'll get that. And not far from there was this place called Brennan's, which is, I don't think it, now it's not there anymore, but it was another longstanding place where it was like a Hofbräu, but lots of gamblers went there. They hang out at places like that.
Well, I can tell you this, that your decision to stay or move back to Berkeley after your time in Ohio, even if it was just based on the food, I can't blame you because there's nowhere in the world that people like there's nowhere in the world that's like Ohio that could potentially ruin them with food more than Skyline Chili. So,
well, no, I'll tell you, Ohio, when I was back there, Cleveland was very cold in the winter, very hot in the summer. There were a couple of Cleveland was at that time, it was a long time ago, broken up into different ethnic areas, and there were great Hungarian restaurants there, and there were also great delicatessens in what was called Shaker Heights, Ohio.
So
you get fresh bread and bagels and things like that, and then you could go to the Hungarian thing. So there was good food, but it was sort of focused on certain types of food.
See, I spent 9 months in Dayton, Ohio, and Dayton, Ohio is a special place on the planet because I was there from like August until May or June the following year. And Dayton, Ohio has this weird environment where you don't see the sun ever except for maybe 1 or 2 days in February. And that's it. So Dayton, Ohio is off my list of places that have almost any value at all. And they can come at me in the comments too. They know where they live.
I met somebody from Akron, Ohio. Which is
that's close
about 40 miles south of Cleveland. And I was sort of complaining about some parts. I said, there's a lot of crime. It's so cold here. You know, I'm from Berkeley. And he said, hey, you're lucky. I'm from Akron. He said, I'd love to go get a job in Cleveland.
That's great. No, and I like Cleveland. It's just down the road from Erie. You know, you have the lake.
They have teams.
It's not like Rochester where it has the smell. Is it's how I differentiate.
And they it's kind of there are a lot of really good things about Cleveland.
Yeah. No.
But Cleveland, I was just homesick for Berkeley.
Yeah. No, I don't blame you. I think that central northern California Bay Area is absolutely beautiful, and I think you've chosen the right place. So I really want to thank you for the time you've spent with me today. And I know we've gone over what I told you we would, but I think that it's been absolutely an interesting interview. And I want to remind everyone that your book is available on Amazon. Check the links in the show notes. But it's called The Story of Chance, Beyond the Margin of Error. It is you mostly something you also use as a textbook in the college, correct?
Yes. Now, the book does not have problem sets in it. What I do is, so I when I teach online, we have a platform that the students log into and they can see stuff. And I post problem sets and other things that aren't in the book.
Yeah.
And the book is mainly stories, but it has all the math for a beginning course. It's not super, it's just for an elementary statistics course. So the math isn't complicated for my subs. Like these stories that I told you about now, this evening, are from the book. Anybody can get the book. And I try to sort of distill, like I said before, distill some of these stories and put them on Substack. As I said, tonight will be, I'm going to try to post the Paul the Octopus story.
Very cool. Well, I'm glad we got to talk about it. And it'll be, you'll obviously have published that well before the episode comes out because, you know, that's how we do our math statistically.
Right.
You'll be ready.
Yeah.
Well, as we like to do with our guests before we let you go, I told you before we started recording, we have a couple segments that we like to do. One of them is called Seven Questions. The other is we call it what did I call it?
This is controversial
opinions. Yeah, thank you. Obviously, controversial opinions requires my other hosts to be here because with controversial opinions, we give you our controversial opinions, and then you have to choose which one you agree with the most. They aren't here to do it, so I'm going to do seven questions with you. So these are seven questions we ask all our guests. The first one is, what was the last thing you Googled?
The last thing I Googled? What was the last thing I Googled? It was information on a restaurant near here.
Okay, that's fair.
I looked at the Yelp reviews.
I don't blame you. Honestly, between Google and Yelp reviews, I think that I'm likely to have a better experience based on the reviews. The number of reviews helps. More statistical data.
That's right.
That helps. Yeah. All right. Number two, if you could have one superpower, what would it be?
To be immortal.
Okay. I see. That's one of those ones I fear. And the reason I say that is because on TikTok, there was a filter that you could do. And every time I ran that filter, it said that I was going to live to be 999. I have never, ever wanted to be euthanized so much in my entire life than when TikTok came back like 7 or 8 times in a row claiming that I was going to live to be 999.
Yeah.
All right. Question number three. If your life were a movie, what would the opening soundtrack to that movie be?
Oh my gosh. It would probably be the theme from Godfather. I just picked that. It would be some one of the soundtracks from movies I really like.
I just pictured.
So, yeah.
That's fair. That's not bad. I one of these days I'm going to have somebody ask me these questions because I think that my pick would have been Ben Folds Underground from like 1994, 93 or something like that. But I'm a huge Ben Folds fan. So. All right. Question number four. If you could eat one food for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Chicken.
Any special prepared any special way?
Grilled.
Okay.
And barbecued.
If you had said boiled, I was going to call the police. We have a sociopath on our hands. All right.
Well, some chicken dishes are like fricasseed chicken.
Sure.
Involves boiling.
That's true, but there's preparation that comes after the boiling.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Question number five. What is your least favorite candy and why?
My least favorite candy?
Yeah.
It would be some hard candy that I could break my tooth on.
So you're not the guy carrying Werther's around in your pocket.
No, although sometimes I have Ricolas, which are hard candy, but that's because I get dry throat, and if I'm going to be talking, like when I lecture to my class for a long time, I got to have something to lubricate my throat.
I do not blame you. All right, question number six. What is one strange or unusual talent you have?
Well, I have good intuition in math.
That's good. Also, I was going to tell you, I studied applied mathematics in college. That was my major. So,
excellent.
Number seven. This is the last one. If you could have dinner with any three people, dead or alive, who would they be?
Well, the first one would be that comes to mind is Einstein.
Okay.
And then probably there was a mathematician named Cantor, Cantor, who. I guess he was in the 17th or 18th century. Anyway, he was a brilliant mathematician. When I was in graduate school, I studied some of his stuff. Anyway, he would be number two. That's an interesting question. I just keep thinking about these different mathematicians. But let's just keep the mathematicians here. So number three would be Gödel, Kurt Gödel, who was the famous mathematician who, in the early 20th century, who proved that you can't have a theory about everything. There are always some things that can't be proved from within that theory.
That's good. So, no, and it's interesting because, you know, every time we ask that question, a lot of people generally go with either celebrities or they go with, yeah. And Einstein, in my opinion, is a celebrity.
Right.
I get when you mentioned Einstein and then Cantor, the next one I thought of was, well, obviously Galileo should fall in there.
Yeah,
somewhere.
Galileo or yeah. Sir Isaac Newton,
yeah.
Of course, is another
yeah.
one.
That would have been.
Yeah, well, I could go on, but Gödel was a very interesting guy. When he was from, I guess, Austria, and when he was here, he came here to Princeton, and when he went to become a citizen. He had a test to become a citizen. He was with John von Neumann, another famous one of the inventors of computer science.
Yeah,
Gödel went to the court to show that he knew the Constitution, and when he was there, he whispered to von Neumann that he had found a flaw in the Constitution which would enable the dictator to take over. This is like in the 1940s, and. Then when the judge started asking, whoever it was asking about the Constitution, he said, you know, he was great, he knew everything, but he said, but I have found a flaw. And von Neumann elbows him and tells him to shut up.
We could have used that.
That's right. And nobody knows what the flaw that he found was, but it seems relevant today.
I feel like there's a possibility we could probably plug that into ChatGPT and maybe it would tell us what right. the flaw in the Constitution is.
Right.
I'm going to do that now. That is something we will probably discuss on the we. So every Tuesday and Thursday we do what's called the Kinda Daily Show, where myself and Bill Kimmler, who also hosts a podcast, political podcast here in South Carolina called Black, White, and Blue in the South. Every Tuesday and Thursday at 5:30 a.m. Eastern, we get together and go live so that we can discuss either politics or news or we can let him rant about how he didn't like the Superman movie. And then I use that as shorts across all of social media, and the attacks on him have been perfect.
That's good.
But all right. Well, Dr. Orkin, I am not going to keep you any longer, but I just want to remind everybody, Dr. Orkin's book is available on Amazon. It is called The Story of Chance Beyond the Margin of Error. You can check that out. Also has a webpage, drmikeorkin.com. It's drmikeorkin.com. Again, links in the show notes, as well as your Substack. We're going to make sure that people have that as well so that they can go check that out and subscribe. Well, you know, anything else that you want to tell us about before we get out of here?
No, that's it.
Okay.
I mean, those are the main things, my website, but my Substack, I'm really into it right now because I'm trying to take all the math out of these things and have little nice little stories.
It's fun. Honestly, I think that the part you're doing is you're teaching, and you're doing it in a fun way. And I think that that's one of the biggest takeaways is that people should go and look at this. My children have already already looked at some of the stories out of the book, so they've enjoyed it, and they're fifth graders, so
okay, good.
You know, if they take after me, then they'll have a life indebted to mathematics anyway.
Yeah, applied math, right?
Well, Dr. Orkin, I want to thank you again for being on the show. Going to close it out. That's going to do it for episode number 266. Links to all of our past episodes, podcast platforms, merchandise, and social media are available on our webpage, theallaboutnothing.com. And if you think our financial model of giving away free content and entertainment is silly and you're in the giving mood, why not become an official Nothinger and support the show? Members get early access to this episode as well as exclusive content. You can visit members.theallaboutnothing.com or you can find a link on our webpage. You can also give us a one-time donation through the same link. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can call and leave us a message, 803-672-0533, or email show at theallaboutnothing.com. You can also join our Discord server, links found on our webpage. Thank you for listening, everybody. You all stay safe, be kind, keep your hands to yourself, and just to quote our president, and may every day be another wonderful secret. The All About Nothing podcast is a product of Big Media and produced and engineered by me, Barrett Gruber. Thanks to Cake for our intro music, Sick of You. You can follow everything Cake the band at cakemusic.com. Thanks to Muff the producer for our outro music. You can follow Muff on Instagram at Muff the producer. You can follow me across social media by visiting linktree.com/Barrett Gruber. And you can follow Zach King on linktree.com/AAN Zach. Want to support the show? Visit our webpage, theallaboutnothing.com, and become a member. There are several tiers available that give you early access to episodes as well as exclusive content. To find links to our social media, podcast platforms, and merchandise to support the show, as well as past episodes, visit theallaboutnothing.com. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can email theshow@theallaboutnothing.com, or you can call our number and leave a message. Dial 803-672-0533. If the time between these episodes is more than you can handle, check out our sister shows. What the Pod Was That with Carrie, Zach, and myself. Welcome to Wonderland with Ami. Politically Speaking with Erica, Kirsten, and Emily. And Black, White, and Blue in the South with Dr. Jamil Brooks and Bill Kimmler. Please subscribe and share this show. If you're on YouTube, please subscribe and punch that notification bell. Thank you for listening and hear us next week. The preceding podcast is a product of Big Media, LLC, and is copyright 2025, all rights reserved.